This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO.org. If you are interested in donating your services and having your work associated with this historic event, a Navigator communications team is forming. If you are someone who can take direction, has initiative, good follow-through, and has excellent written and verbal communication skills, and you have 2 to 4 hours each week to contribute making calls, sending emails, and being part of a social media squad, attend a meeting Sunday, March 3rd at 1 p.m. at KBOO. Refreshments will be provided. For more information, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. Thank you.
KBOO would like to invite you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs.
You'll hear Henry and Moggy singing Down Home Ragtime and Country.
The True Vine Ramblers, a traditional bluegrass band totally comprised of current hosts of music from the True Vine, along with their special guests and former hosts, Deanne Nelson and Jim Seafelt.
Don McLaren and his fiddling friends playing old-time fiddle tunes.
And Retta Christie and her one-night stand band, bringing her brand of music that swings between the recesses of jazz and country.
That's Once in a Boo Moon at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church on Saturday, February 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m.
Doors open wide at 6 p.m., so come early. As also included are coffee, delectable desserts, a silent auction, and raffles.
For full details, go to kboo.fm and click on Once in a Boo Moon under KBOO Events. All proceeds go to benefit KBOO, your community radio station.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News,
the addition of microphones on TriMet buses raises questions on public versus private space.
A renewable energy bill gets the backing of Oregon state representatives.
The United Nations decides to remove the founder of an Oregon charity from its terrorist list. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 12, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Alex Ford. TriMet will soon be adding listening devices to its coaches as part of a federal surveillance program, but the real issue may be about definitions of public versus private space. KBOO's Don Merrill has more.
In October, a TriMet fare inspector kicked a rider off the carrier's platform at the Cedar Hills Sunset Transit Center. The rider was arguing with the inspector when the inspector ejected the rider, telling him he had no free speech rights to argue with him. That case is currently in federal court. Another issue, though, is about to test the line between what is considered TriMet's public and private space. 55 of TriMet's new 3000 series buses will be outfitted with microphone-embedded cameras. Not only will they be able to see individuals on the buses, but they'll be able to associate speech with faces. This is a much more expansive use of surveillance than was possible with the GPS microphones that have been in TriMet buses for the last decade. Those could be activated by the driver in case of an emergency, but a TriMet employee who spoke on the condition of anonymity said supervisors have said in employee meetings with employees, "Some of you don't sing very well," implying that they could be turned on by dispatch at random and without the driver's knowledge. These new installations are part of funding for a program called InfraGuard, launched during the Bush administration. According to its website, InfraGuard is a cooperative program between the FBI and the private sector. Its mission is to monitor critical infrastructure like mass transit systems for threats against the population or that infrastructure. As part of the rolling out of the new surveillance technology on the buses, TriMet says the buses are public spaces, so conversations are no more protected than they would be on a city street. But as the free speech lawsuit currently in federal court shows, TriMet is not entirely clear on when its property and equipment is or isn't a public space. KBOO will continue to follow this story. I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
Portland's Mayor Charlie Hales recently ordered all city bureaus to submit budget proposals reflecting 10% across-the-board cuts in city funding. These cuts may have profound effects on the city's workers and people in poverty. The Portland Housing Bureau may cut or eliminate a number of services in rent assistance, winter and youth shelters, and drug and mental health outreach, which would impact the city's homeless. The cuts may also affect a number of programs that give the homeless pathways to home ownership, including Rent Well, Shared Housing, Home Buyer Fairs, and the Home Buyer Retention Program. Meanwhile, unionized service workers in every city bureau are nervous about losing their jobs. The District Council of Trade Unions, or DCTU, a coalition representing 1,600 city workers, will focus on job security during this year's city contract negotiations. While Hale's plan aims to preserve core services, workers are wary of bureaucrats drawing up proposed cuts. DCTU says the city should cut managers and stop contracting non-union labor before it asks Union Hall for sacrifices.
The United Nations has removed the founder of an Oregon-based charity from its terrorism list. Solomon Al-Bouthi was one of several men indicted by the U.S. government for their work with the Al-Haramain charity based in Ashland, which provided funding, school, and medical supplies to children in Palestine. Tom Nelson, the attorney in the case, says that the United Nations decision to remove Al-Bouthi was in another recognition of his innocence. Nelson called on the U.S. government to do the same and admit its mistake in targeting the foundation. He spoke today with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg.
What is the significance of the removal of Solomon Al-Bouthi from the United Nations terrorism list?
Yeah, I think it's extremely significant because it goes back to the very early days in 2004 when the United States government initially designated Mr. Al-Bouthi and Al-Haramain Islamic Foundation and froze its assets and has since gone into non-existence. And in 2005, when the government indicted Pete Seda, now Pete Seda was the former director of, along with Mr. Al-Bouthi, of Al-Haramain. When they indicted Pete Seda, they didn't say, as a matter of fact, the U.S. attorney told me, there is no charge of terrorism in here. Mr. Al-Bouthi, after that, tried to challenge his designation as a terrorist by the Treasury Department, by the U.S. government, and was unsuccessful. We are still trying to do that, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. But fortunately, in 2009, the United Nations adopted procedures wholly unlike those used by the U.S. government in determining whether somebody should be on a terrorist list. In the United States, they don't have to provide reasons. They often don't. They do it on a whim, and when you challenge them, they immediately button up and say national security, state secret. The United Nations, because of a European Court of Justice case that came out in 2009, no longer does that. The United Nations requires that the country that designates somebody as a terrorist back it up, and provide reasons, and also provides a trained attorney, in this case, ombudsperson Kimberly Prost, who is a Canadian lawyer, to go and investigate the facts behind the designation or the listing. As a result, Ms. Prost came to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and met with Mr. Al-Bouthi a number of times, and met with me, and she investigated the claims of that Mr. Al-Bouthi was affiliated or linked to Al-Qaeda. By the way, the claim of linking to Al-Qaeda was subsequently dropped by the United States, and its redesignation happened later. I think they realized their mistake after we pointed it out to them.
So there's no link between Al-Bouthi and Al-Qaeda?
Absolutely none.
And the U.S. government has admitted that at this point?
Well, they will never say it. The government never admits anything. But what they did is they stopped saying it when they went to justify the designation of Mr. Al-Bouthi by the United States. Equally important, is the fact that Mr. Al-Bouthi is a citizen of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia takes Al-Qaeda threats very, very seriously. When he was designated by the United States, they did an investigation. Matter of fact, they did two separate investigations of him by the Ministry of the Interior, which is includes the secret police and whatnot in Saudi Arabia. And on both occasions, they cleared him completely. And as a result of that, he retained his government job.
Well, thanks very much. Again, I've been speaking with attorney Tom Nelson, whose client, Soleiman Al-Bouthi, has been removed from the United Nations terrorist list. This is Jenka Soderbergh with KBOO News.
While most people are aware of the stress and danger police and emergency responders face, very little is known about the traumas correctional officers experience. According to the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, about one-third of correctional officers, those who oversee prisons and jails, have post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. Their job involves exposure to violence, injury, and death, similar to emergency responders and military personnel, according to a study by the Desert Waters Correctional Outreach. The report claims that the high incidence of PTSD among correctional officers is due to the daily threat of physical injury and occasional exposure to arson and riots. In fact, correctional officers have a higher rate of PTSD symptoms than military personnel and firefighters. Organizations like Desert Waters Correctional Outreach are working to shed more light on the effects of PTSD among correctional officers and the overall effects on prison governance.
Advocates of marriage equality in Oregon have formed a petition committee to bring the issue of gay marriage to voters in 2014. The Freedom to Marry and Religious Protection Initiative would overturn the 2004 constitutional amendment banning gay marriage in Oregon. Robin Ryan spoke with Gianna Frazzini, Executive Director at Basic Rights Oregon, about the goals of their new initiative, Oregon United for Marriage.
What's your plan to put gay marriage on the agenda for the 2014 legislative session?
This is actually an effort to do an initiative on the ballot in November of 2014 that voters will have the opportunity to vote on. Oregon is one of a number of states across the country where the legislature and the courts don't have the ability to change the policy on marriage. It has to be a vote of the people. So we established a petition committee yesterday on Monday, February 11th. That is Oregon United for Marriage, and we filed the language for the Freedom to Marry and Religious Protection Initiative that will now begin the process of getting to the ballot for November 2014.
And can you tell us how the initiative process is different from other approaches to legislation?
Sure. So laws can be created through the courts and the state legislature. The courts can address constitutional issues, but the Oregon Supreme Court has declined to address this the issue of marriage. And the state legislature doesn't have the power to change the Constitution without a vote of the people. So the only option remaining is to take an initiative directly to the voters, the question essentially will be to ask voters to make it legal for gay and lesbian couples to marry in the state of Oregon.
What impact do you expect the Washington state's measure allowing gay marriage to have on your work?
Well, I think that there's been a really significant shift in this country and even in our own state in terms of how the public understands and has come to support marriage for same-sex couples. The vote in Washington state and in Maine and in Maryland, where they just last November, all three states voters affirmed the freedom to marry, is a really positive indication of how quickly things are changing. Before last November, we had marriage asserted in the states through the courts and through the legislatures, and now by a vote of the people. And now we have the opportunity to affirm the freedom to marry in our state constitution here in Oregon, and that's what we're seeking to do in an effort that brings Oregonians together, organizations and business leaders, elected officials, and supporters and individuals from every corner of the state of Oregon to step forward and support gay and lesbian families and make this change happen.
You guys have a tour coming up?
Yeah. So Basic Rights Oregon created Oregon United for Marriage this week. And essentially what our goal is to establish that sort of space for the coalition to come together. We've had hundreds of organizations and thousands of individuals supporting our work to build support for the freedom to marry for many years. And as it's time to take the next step into the campaign, we're inviting folks to come together as Oregon United for Marriage. So people are will be traveling around the state on Thursday, Valentine's Day. There's more than 12 towns across Oregon where we're holding events, and folks are being invited. The public is invited. Our supporters are invited to sign the petitions that day. There's information and details at OregonUnitedForMarriage.org, and right here in Portland, we'll be downtown at Hotel Monaco from 3 to 7 p.m. with petitions available for folks to sign.
That's BasicRightsOregon.org or OregonUnitedForMarriage.org. This has been Robin Ryan with KBOO News.
In his last act as the outgoing defense secretary, Leon Panetta signed an order yesterday that offered some benefits to same-sex couples serving in the military. But these benefits are still only a portion of what opposite-sex couples receive. For the first time, same-sex couples with one member in the military will be able to declare that they have a domestic partnership and be eligible for benefits. Same-sex couples in the military can also now request that they be assigned to the same post, but priority will be given to opposite-sex couples when deciding housing. They will also be able to receive pay and benefits if their partner is taken prisoner or is missing in action. However, same-sex couples are still denied many of the benefits that heterosexual couples receive. Partners of gay or lesbian service members still do not have access to military medical facilities and expedited visas as heterosexual couples do. Same-sex couples also cannot request their partner's burial at Arlington National Cemetery. Panetta's successor, Chuck Hagel, was approved this afternoon by the Senate Armed Services Committee. During his confirmation hearing, Hagel said that he would pursue additional benefits for gay and lesbian service members.
A forum was held last night at the University of Oregon on whether to arm campus police with guns. And Portland State University is having a student-led forum this evening on the same topic. Both universities are trying to figure out how to deal with a marked increase in assaults, including sexual assaults, on their campuses. Currently, no member of the University of Oregon's 13-member campus police carries a firearm. Eugene District Attorney Alex Gardner stressed that high crime rates and homicide rates in Lane County require more security at the University of Oregon. Most students at the forum expressed suspicion or opposition to arming the campus police.
The National Rifle Association, or NRA, has been calling for its Washington state members to contact legislators who support a proposed bill that would require background checks for firearm sales between private parties. Currently, background checks are only mandatory for sales involving federally licensed firearm dealers. The bill is supported by Republican Representative Mike Hope of Lake Stevens, a Seattle police officer who just last year received a 100% rating from the NRA. Hope believes that the bill is a reasonable step towards keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally ill. Since his vote could help decide the outcome, he's been targeted by the NRA in a memo to its Washington members. The memo makes some claims that Hope finds erroneous, for example, that the background check process would be full of obstacles and costs for gun buyers, and the information from them would be maintained in a national database of guns and gun owners. Hope says that background checks would cost about $20 at any local gun shop or police station, and their info will not be maintained after the check is complete. The Republican lawmaker has recently received about 300 emails echoing these misperceptions. State senators have also been the target of the NRA, including other Republicans and the Democratic majority leader.
United Natural Foods Incorporated, or UNFI, will reinstate 72 workers who had been permanently replaced at its Auburn, Washington distribution warehouse as part of a deal reached with Teamsters Local 117 to end the strike that began in early December. Other provisions in the agreement include a contract calling for wage increases of nearly 18% over 5 years, according to a press release issued today by the Organic Consumers Association, or OCA. A spokesperson for the Teamsters said the campaign included 24-hour picket lines around the warehouse in Auburn and leafletting at Whole Foods markets. UNFI came back to the bargaining table amid a backlash from area food co-ops and bad press from the widely circulated article by Ronnie Cummins, national director for OCA, and Dave Murphy, founder of Food Democracy Now!, which publicized an investigation regarding 45 violations of federal labor laws.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this local newscast, followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's show welcomes local singer-songwriter Ashley Flynn into KBOO's studio performing her latest music. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rain with a high of 48 degrees.
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Wall Street bankers have such fun. I don't mean merely at their year-end bonus bashes, when each one rakes in more dollar bills than a tall tree has leaves, but year-round. For example, one group of scamps are paid to invent crazy investment packages that go bang after unsuspecting suckers, otherwise known as customers, buy them. Called CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, such packages were the nuclear whoopee cushions that in 2007 crashed the housing market and our entire economy. Yet not a single one of these financial rascals was held accountable by federal authorities, so we commoners have not even been told about the details of the destructive inside jokes they were playing on us. However, a lawsuit filed against Morgan Stanley by a Taiwanese bank has now laid bare one of these prank investment packages titled Stack. This $500 million CDO was literally stacked against those who bought it, including the Taiwan bank, because Morgan's fun-loving packagers deliberately filled it with bad housing loans. Here's the punchline. Morgan Stanley secretly put down a $170 million bet that the load of investment garbage it put in stack would cause the CDO to fail, which it did. In short, these Wall Street jesters created Stack so Morgan Stanley could bet against it and cash in, even as the bank peddled it around the world as a safe and sound investment. The lawsuit unleashed an especially fun set of exchanges among the bankers over what to name their mischievous CDO. Hitman, suggested one. Nuclear Holocaust, offered another. But the most telling title idea was A Bag of Excrement. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, they are the real bags of excrement. Yet by refusing to prosecute them, the government has winked at their hilarity, allowing them to keep doing their slapstick CDO routines.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, recently released a draft on how its programs will adapt to global climate change. In 2009, President Obama issued an executive order that all government agencies will submit such plans to a newly created White House Council of Environmental Quality. This approach would enable the government to address changes caused by global warming without going through Congress, which is extremely divided and unreliable on the issue of climate change. The EPA's draft is a short 55 pages, but is likely to garner some of the most attention in the 2 months of public comment following the release of each agency's plan. The EPA's proposal is likely to have an effect on the regulation of carbon emissions and fuel efficiency. Unchanging congressional gridlock has prompted activists to call on Obama to deliver more executive orders in response to global climate change and sidestep the legislative quagmire.
Members of Congress from both parties in 8 western states are backing a bill to increase renewable energy development, protect public lands and wildlife, and provide a new income source for counties and states. We go to KBOO Sequoia Wright in conjunction with the Oregon News Service for more on the story.
A bill introduced Monday in Congress would require wind and solar developers to compete for public land leases, bidding on the places they want to site their projects. Once those projects were up and running, they'd have to pay royalties. The money would be split between the state, counties, the BLM, and just over one-third of it would go into a wildlife and land conservation fund. Oregon Representatives Blumenauer and DeFazio are back in the Public Lands and Renewable Energy Development Act. And Nick Calero with the National Wildlife Federation says it should boost this type of development in Oregon.
That's a relatively new idea for renewable energy projects. It's a system that we've already used on public lands for conventional energy projects. And what this does is basically evens the playing field for renewable projects versus conventional oil and gas projects.
Calero's group believes a competitive leasing process should mean developers will avoid controversial areas with critical habitat concerns, to save time and money. The bill has sponsors from both parties in 8 Western states. The Senate version is expected to be heard in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, chaired by Senator Ron Wyden. Bob Reese, who heads the Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, says hunters and fishermen have 2 big fears about energy development of any kind on the public land that will damage fish and wildlife habitat and restrict access. But he says the bill addresses them both.
It just makes a lot of sense. It develops energy that this country is going to desperately need in the future. And more importantly, most importantly, in some people's minds, it's green energy, you know, and that has a much smaller overall footprint on the environment.
The National Wildlife Federation says since 2007, just over 40 renewable energy projects have been approved on public land in the U.S., along with more than 7,000 oil and gas projects. Conservation groups are convinced that this bill could pick up the pace for green power. For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, this is Sequoyah Wright.
A disabled Ohio woman had her power cut off this week for refusing to allow a so-called smart meter to be installed in her home. The new meter uses radio frequency technology that Brenda Hawk says would interfere with her pacemaker and breathing equipment. After a sheriff accompanied a power company employee to her house to try to force installation of this smart meter, Hawk is now without power during the coldest part of Ohio's winter. She posted this video on YouTube describing what happened.
Early this morning, the Allen County Sheriff's Department and the AEP Electric Company came to my home and were here to turn off my power if I didn't agree to put an RFM meter on my home. And I asked the Allen County Sheriff if he was here to protect my property rights, and he said, "No, ma'am, I'm here to protect AEP, and you'll either have the meter or we'll turn your power off." So I said, "Well, do whatever you have to do." I said, "You can take the meter, but you cannot put the ARF meter or radio frequency meter on my home because I have a pacemaker, and it can interfere with the workings of my pacemaker, and I also have a breathing machine that has to work at night, and some of these radio frequencies will disturb some of your medical equipment." So they decided, "Well, we're just going to turn your power off then." So that's what they did. They did not, in fact, they did not take the meter. They left the analog meter on the home and never did put the RFM on or take the analog off, but they did take the power off at the pole. So as of now, I will be without power or water for as long as they decide that I won't put the meter on. So I find this a little disconcerting that in our state that we have no rights to have an option as to whether we want this meter or we want to opt out. And all I asked for is a guarantee that the meter would not do any harm to my property or my home or my pacemaker. And AEP refuses to give me a guarantee on this. And even their PUCO, the Public Utilities Commission, also refuses to admit that they can or cannot give a guarantee on the meter. So it makes you wonder, what are they hiding if they won't give you the information you need to make an educated decision on whether to take the meter or not take the meter?
Electric companies claim that the radio frequency from smart meters is far less than cell phone exposure. But a report by globalresearch.ca found that continual exposure to radio frequency waves from smart meters could have impacts on people's health. Smart meters are being installed at homes all across the country. There's been no federal testing of smart meters, and they are not required to carry the UL label, which is mandated for other electronic devices. Several types of smart meters, including those used by PG&E here in Oregon, have been shown to have power spikes of up to 50,000 hertz. In 2011, a power company in Maine was taken to court after numerous people became ill following smart meter installations. A landmark legal decision in that case marked the first time any state has ordered an electric utility to permit customers the choice to opt out of a smart meter program.
Concerns have been raised in Denver, Colorado about safety issues as the legalization of the sale of marijuana looms at the end of the year. According to reports, regulators are facing issues with the cultivation of weed that only delivers the effects that pot smokers want, as well as how to grow weed without the harmful effects of pesticides and fungicides, and how to apply accurate product labels. Officials say that they won't be getting much help with the safety concerns from federal agencies that regulate food and drugs due to the fact that pot is not yet legalized in the state of Colorado. This means that states like Colorado will need to start from scratch to protect consumers from pot that could be tainted with mold, mildew, and other unwanted chemicals. What the state of Colorado has detailed for production safety guidelines so far are the chemicals that cannot be used on marijuana, such as arsenic and mercury. Medical marijuana product safety has long been a concern in Colorado, and reports from critics say that regulations were, quote, too loosely relaxed, and any new regulations for pot use should be examined closely.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, February 12, 2013. Israeli troops take over a Palestinian home in the West Bank and arrest a man at the Gaza borders. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian political detainee Samer Isawi lawyers announced today that he is in critical conditions after 195 days of hunger strike in an Israeli prison. Fadi Abedat, a lawyer for the Palestinian Ministry of Prisoners Affairs, who visited Isawi at Ramla Prison Clinic, said that Isawi has severe leg, kidney, head and chest pains and a slow pulse. He is unable to move or sleep, the ministry said in a statement. According to the lawyer, Isawi's weight had dropped to 46 kilograms and he was struggling to speak. Isawi was released back in October 2011 during the prisoner swap deal between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel. On July of this year, Isawi was arrested again by the Israeli army. In other news, Israeli troops stormed the village of Ya'bud near the northern West Bank city of Jenin and took over a Palestinian house under construction. Residents said that troops took over the house of Amin Abu Bakr and are using it as a military base.